From Ohio to Florida, Nebraska to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, everyone, it seems, is fighting for their rights. But do Americans today know where their rights come from? Timothy Snowball of the Pacific Legal Foundation is here to talk about our nation's founding principles. Mississippi will have a new U.S. senator, and that sets the stage for an interesting special election. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. Republicans and Democrats have gotten together behind a huge new spending bill. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Veronique Therugi of the Mercatus Center. And political discussions today result more in people shouting at rather than talking to each other. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary on coping with disagreement. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence that our basic American rights are self-evident and that we are endowed by our Creator. In other words, rights are given by God and not by government. Timothy Snowball of the Pacific Legal Foundation is writing a series of articles entitled Principles of the American Founding. He is here to discuss those principles. Tim, welcome to American Radio Journal. Timothy, when we talk about principles of the American founding, one of the core principles that was introduced right out of the chute in the Declaration of Independence was this whole idea of natural rights, or where our rights come from. And since we seem as a society to spend a lot of time arguing over rights these days, tell us what those documents say about our rights and where, in fact, they do come from.
The theory that the founders really based the country on was the idea that natural rights are really God-given. Jefferson does a pretty interesting rhetorical thing in the Declaration of Independence, where he talks about laws of nature and of nature's God, but also grounds natural rights in being self-evident. So he approaches it from a theological perspective and also a philosophical perspective. According to Locke and Jefferson's sense, natural rights pre-exist the institution of government, and the purpose of legitimate government is to secure our natural rights. Now, to the end that government is unable to do that, it then becomes the right of the people to abolish that government or modify that government to achieve that end.
And as we look at this evolution throughout the century since Thomas Jefferson wrote those words, do you sense now that there's a fairly significant portion of the American population that believes that our rights actually come from the government and are not God-given rights?
I would say so. I would say so, and I'm not sure where exactly you trace that to. I think public education is probably a real problem. I was lucky enough to have some excellent, excellent history teachers early on in my education that really sparked an interest for me in these ideas, and this has carried me through for a lifetime. But if I was going to trace it to a historical period, it would probably be the early 20th century, the Progressive Era, in particular the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, where they had gone, well, you know, God, like these checks and balances that the Constitution puts into place, this really takes too long. You know, it's slowing things down, and we have progress we want to make, so we're going to try to find a way to get around this stuff. And it's unfortunate, and I think it's downright dangerous, because when rights become a gift of government, when government can dispense rights, that also means that they can do away with rights, they can modify rights. And I think especially when it comes to the protections contained in the Bill of Rights and very specific things, that's a very dangerous line to cross. And once you start going down that road, you see examples like, I think, the Fourth Amendment. Jurisprudence of the Supreme Court is probably a good example of that, where you now have so many judicially crafted exceptions and different rules. None of that is in the text of the amendment itself, and now it's become so watered down, I think it really gets away from the intention of the founders.
One of the principles of our founding fathers, Tim, was this idea of everybody having the opportunity to pursue happiness. And as we look at these principles and the right to life and liberty, et cetera, do those documents guarantee outcomes? It seems that that's where we're focused these days, where folks look at these words and they say, well, as a result of that, we should have not only all men being created equal, but all men ought to have everything equal and the outcome ought to be equal. Is that really what they meant?
I think that that's a total aberration from what it, from what they meant. And it's an interesting thing that you bring up in terms of not only should individuals be aware of what rights they have, but aware of the nature of those rights. So the rights contained in the Declaration of Independence and of the Bill of Rights are what's called negative rights. And what that means is they're basically your right to be left alone, right? To pursue your life, to pursue your happiness. It's basically a list of what the government cannot do to you and you cannot be compelled to do. Now, that's a far cry from making claims against your neighbors or feeling that you're owed something. Now, you can't be guaranteed a happy life. But what the government can guarantee is the government cannot interfere with your own ability to take your own initiative to pursue your own happiness.
So basically, we all start out at the starting gate the same, but where we end up, that's to our own initiative, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that especially given current levels of spending in the United States, where we bring it back to Roosevelt. Roosevelt, I think, later on toward his, what did he serve? 7, 8 terms? I think it was 4, but
it seemed like it.
he had close enough. He had tried to institute a new Bill of Rights. This is the new Bill of Rights that I want to put into effect. And it was, everyone has a right to a home. Everyone has a right to a job. Everyone has a right to a living. And this entire laundry list where basically the government would be responsible for the happiness and caring for each individual from the cradle to the grave. And not only do I think that from a financial perspective that's unsustainable for the country, but it's a level of government control and coercion in the lives of individuals that it goes far beyond anything that the founders, I think, could have imagined.
And that leads us into the next article that you have written, which is that government must be limited. Tell us why it is important that we keep a limit on government.
Well, certainly, and I think that one of the interesting things you can look at, I remember when I was in college and I had a little bit of experience with this, it's called public choice theory. And basically what public choice theory posits is that the incentives that affect individuals, those don't stop once somebody becomes a politician or a member of Congress, right? I think it was James Madison who said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary, right? And so what you have to look at is those individuals who run for office. Now, they're probably motivated by high ideals, sure, but they're still going to be power hungry. And anyone put into a position of power is going to want more power, right? And so it was really a very elegant way that the framers set up our constitutional system, right? Checks and balances, set up the three branches, not only to in opposition to each other, but with their own distinct powers and overlapping authority over each other. It was really an elegant and a beautiful system. It's become the most copied and the most successful constitutional system in the history of mankind.
We have been talking with Timothy Snowball, the Pacific Legal Foundation. He's writing a series of articles, Principles of the American Founding. Timothy, tell us a little bit about the Pacific Legal Foundation. Also, where can folks go to read this series of articles?
Sure. So please visit our website. It's going to be pacificlegal.org. You can also follow me on Twitter. It's tsnowball_ESQ. The Pacific Legal Foundation is the most active, most successful public interest organization, I think, in the country. We are 100% nonprofit. We don't charge our clients for anything. And our entire goal since 1973 has been to rein in big government and to protect individual rights. So we're very active, and I encourage everyone to look us up and check out the important work that we do.
Timothy Snowball of the Pacific Legal Foundation. Tim, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Andy Roth is at the Club for Growth. He, of course, is in Washington, D.C., where we have yet another omnibus budget deal, which is never good for taxpayers. We're going to get to that in just a minute. But, Andy, first of all, good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's talk briefly about what's happening in the state of Mississippi. We have a new U.S. senator who has been appointed, but boy, the situation there is interesting.
Yeah, it is. The incumbent Senator Thad Cochran is resigning due to health reasons, but he won't resign until April 1st. And then at that point, the governor's appointee will then get sworn in. Governor Bryant chose the state's agricultural commissioner, Cindy Hyde Smith. I believe she would be the first female senator in the Deep South. She is a former Democrat. What little we know of her doesn't really speak well as to, it doesn't sound like she's going to be a leader on conservative issues. She seems more like an establishment pick. This is all very interesting because Chris McDaniel, who primary, Thad Cochran, back in 2014, has jumped into this race. So you could see a very, very bloody race. And what's interesting is that this isn't your closed Republican primary. This is going to be a jungle primary where all of the candidates, including the Democrats and any third-party candidates, they all run together on the same ballot in November, and then the top two would advance to a runoff shortly thereafter if nobody gets over 50%. So there's a lot of strategery, as our former president used to say, into how all the votes are going to move in November, and I guess we're just going to see how this plays out. But to Ms. Hyde Smith's credit, or I guess in her favor, she will have several months of incumbency. That didn't work for Luther Strange over in the neighboring Alabama, but it typically does help. We'll just have to see how it goes this time around.
Well, we'll continue to keep an eye on that. The Alabama election, of course, did not end well for conservatives or Republicans, and hopefully the great state of Mississippi does not go the same direction. But let's go back to Washington, D.C. now, Andy, and Congress is in the process of implementing an omnibus spending bill, omnibus being Washington speak for taxpayers lose. Wow, this is a giant spending bill. What's going on?
Senator John Kennedy, no relation to the former president. There's a current senator, a Republican, John Kennedy from Louisiana. He had an amazing quote. He said, quote, "This is a Great Dane-sized whiz down the leg of every taxpayer in America. We don't even know what's in the bill. It wasn't done in front of God or country or the American taxpayer," unquote. And that is a perfect summary of what this is. It's a 2,232-page bill. Nobody has ever really been able to look at it and see what's in it. But what little we do know of it is it increases the size of government. It enshrines the permanent trillion-dollar deficits that the GOP leaders and Democrats agreed to last month. And it's, as far as I can tell, just a Christmas tree of giveaways to all sorts of special interests. And it's ridiculous. Trump is supporting it only because he is getting some of his priorities. But he himself is even admitting that they had to give away a lot of wasteful spending to the Democrats in order for him to get what he wanted. So this is the worst kind of sausage making that you can think of in Washington. And Washington clearly has a spending addiction, and this is the drunk at the bar at 2 a.m. who refuses to leave. He just wants more and more. That's what's going on here.
As I recall, Andy, back in the days of the Obama administration, Republicans in Congress put in what was called a sequester in order to put a cap on spending, both domestic and military spending. And this was viewed as a great accomplishment by Republicans that they were able to rein in the spending of the profligate Barack Obama administration. Does all that go out the window now?
Yeah, the great irony of that 2011 deal is that conservatives opposed it because it raised the debt ceiling, but it did include some powerful spending caps. But the reason why conservatives opposed it is because they didn't think that Congress would ever stick to the spending caps. And this latest budget deal proves it. This is only the last time that they're breaking the deal. In 2013, just 2 years after the budget deal, they started breaking the caps, but only temporary. And then they busted them again 2 years later. And then now they're finally saying, okay, we give up. We couldn't stick to those caps. So all of the good things that occurred in that 2011 bill are washed away with this deal, and it's unfortunate.
Going forward then, of course, the federal budget cycle starts on the first day of October and then runs for 12 months. We haven't really had a budget in, well, decades now. We have had all these continuing resolutions, which then bring us up to threatened shutdowns of the government. With this budget deal, does this now take us through to the end of September, or are we going to have more of this last-minute drama that occurs?
Yeah, we have basically six more months before we encounter another shutdown debate, because nothing about the budget is fixed. when it comes to Democrats and Republicans agreeing on anything. So we'll continue to have omnibuses and CRs and all these ugly things unless something radically changes. Frankly, I think that there's only one solution to all of this, and it's to address it electorally. I think voters need to just get rid of all the people that are supporting these things and replace them with somebody that's willing to change.
Well, speaking of the elections, with Republicans joining with Democrats supporting this, to go back to Senator Kennedy's analogy, did Republicans just sort of whiz all over their brand?
They did. And it's an interesting thing. I don't even know what the Republican brand is anymore. You know, the Republicans have been voting for more and more spending since I can remember. They had some ability to say no to President Obama, but not even then, really. So if Republicans are going to be successful as a party, they have to go back to their roots of limited government. And that includes limited spending. It's not just lower taxes and less regulation. They have to solve the spending problem, and right now they're far, far from it.
We have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, as always, tell us a bit about the club and where folks can go on the web to get more information.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
And now for details on what is included in that omnibus spending bill, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Veronique Therugi of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Eric?
By the time you're listening to this, Congress may very well have already passed a $1.3 trillion spending bill. It's the omnibus budget bill that will keep the government operating through the end of September. Yeah, $1.3 trillion, and all we get is about 6 months' worth of government for that. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is actually the same guest I had last week, Veronique Therugi, senior fellow at the Mercatus Center and a columnist at Reason.com. I don't normally have the same guest on 2 weeks in a row, but Vero was so good a week ago, and she's really a preeminent expert on debts and deficits and budgets, and that's why we had to have her back. Veronique, thanks so much for taking some time and being here on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
As I said before, Veronique, the omnibus budget bill, $1.3 trillion in spending. It's nearly 3,000 pages long, and it was released on Wednesday night. It's going to be voted on sometime Thursday, possibly. We are recording this on Thursday morning, so we have not had time to go all the way through the nearly 3,000 pages of the bill, but I think it's safe to say that no one in Congress is going to have done that either before they cast their vote on this massive spending plan.
That's correct. Yeah, no one has read this bill entirely, and no one will ever have time to. They will certainly will have had no time to discuss and understand what's in the bill, and there's no time to offer amendments to the bill for those who've actually digested some of its content and are unhappy.
Right. So even if you do go through the bill and you find something awful in there, you want to make a change or take some of this spending out, well, there's no time to do it anyway. Let's talk about some of the numbers that we have digested. $1.3 trillion, it's a mind-boggling amount of money, but there's a lot of different things in the bill. Obviously, literally everything the government does is included in this. In terms of new stuff, there's a huge amount of money for a new train tunnel between New York and New Jersey. There's funding for Trump's border wall. There's a massive increase in spending for the Pentagon. What else in here really jumps out to you when you look at it, Veronique?
By the way, this is only the discretionary side of the budget. That does not include the drivers of our future debt: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Interest on our debt is not in there, and this is even more massive. The thing that actually really blows my mind, and I've been complaining about this for a long time, is that they not only bust the budget cap that they set on themselves when President Obama was in power, that actually allowed for government spending to grow, but not grow super fast. So they blow that. They just say, just let's ignore them. We're going to bust them yet again. But it's the amount by which they are willing to bust those caps. $143 billion because the Republicans wanted like a massive increase in defense spending. And the way to get it is to give the Democrats massive increase in non-defense spending above the budget caps. And by the way, you never get this under the Democrats because the Republicans would never allow it.
This is one of those things that can only happen when Republicans are in power. No doubt about that. They would put the brakes on this kind of spending if they were in the minority. We're talking with Veronique DeRougie. She's a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center and a columnist at Reason.com. And she's got a column up at Reason.com today looking at the fiscal impact of the omnibus bill that may very well have already been passed through Congress by the time you are listening to us talk about it. The title of that piece is "The Omnibus Spending Bill is a Fiscal Embarrassment." And I think that sums it up pretty well. One more thing I did want to touch on, Veronique, and that's the fact that this bill is, as we keep saying, it's a $1.3 trillion spending bill, and it blows through all these spending caps that you mentioned earlier. But not only that, it also comes on the heels of last year's passage of tax reform. Now, I'm generally in favor of lower taxes. I think paying less taxes to the government is pretty much good for everybody. I don't want to speak for you, but I think that's something that you've generally supported in the past as well. But this tax cut means that the government will be collecting less revenue in future years, and that's not bad in and of itself. But when you pair that with the fact that we're also going to be spending more and more, you end up with a disconnect that seems like it's problematic for the country's long-term health.
Yes. And by the way, I didn't like everything. I could have done without all the individual side of the tax reform, because for most of it, it won't grow the economy. It's just a giveaway, getting people off the tax roll, so giving tax credits, so basically just and not growing the economy. On the corporate side, there's at least the hope that some of that revenue that is lost will be made up with more revenue in the future because the economy grows faster. But yeah, it is a big problem. We, to tell you how much less revenue and more spending we're going to do, last year in June 2017, when the CBO did a projection of the deficit in 2018, so this fiscal year, it was basically $250 billion less than what we're going to have to do. So in 1 year in power, there's always possibility that the CBO was going to be wrong, but not by $250 billion in 1 year alone. The deficit, this is how much they've piled onto the deficit. Those Republicans who were fully in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House.
And the Republicans, of course, they spent all those many years railing against Obama's debts and deficits. The national debt just hit $21 trillion this week, and it feels like it was just yesterday that we hit $20 trillion. Actually, it was earlier this year, but still feels like yesterday. And there's definitely nothing in this budget bill that is going to change that trajectory, unfortunately. Also, unfortunately, we are out of time for today. Veronique, really appreciate you being here and talking us through what we know about the new spending bill.
Thank you.
That is Veronique DeRougie. She's a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center and a columnist at Reason.com. Read everything that she writes, folks. Read everything that she writes. She's one of the few people out there who really gets the debt and deficit situation right and is one of the few people who's warning about the problems that we've got in that regard. You can check out her latest piece on the omnibus spending bill at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch us right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Have we Americans lost our ability to cope with opinions that conflict with our own? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, talks about this failure to cope on his American Radio Journal commentary.
The deteriorating nature of public discourse and the disdain with which people interact with one another have been at the forefront of many discussions in the past few years. Bullying has apparently gone from beyond the classroom and the schoolyard to the entire spectrum of our society. Whenever disagreements between people in a civilized society reach the point of anger and disrespect, our entire society must be concerned. As a legislator myself, I frequently hear people complain about the lack of cooperation in the government and demand bipartisan solutions, while at the same time they trash or vilify anyone who disagrees with them on virtually every social media forum. Our political process is merely a reflection of our society. This feigned perspective that our government must be above the fray while we are engaged in social media hatred is incomprehensible. The fallacy of logic, called argumentum ad hominem, is one in which the person is attacked and vilified versus the person's position, thereby negating any civilized conversation and resolution of conflict. This same person engaging in an attack on the person's character or intellect is usually the same person who screams that they need a safe space to be protected from those very same discussions from those who disagree with their position. The entire issue of civil discourse is a topic of discussion for the U.S. courts, which has published extensive articles concerning civil discourse and difficult decisions. Embodied in this excellent discourse are the coping skills necessary to allow for that civil discourse. Coping skills are essential to allow for civil discourse and for the advancement of society. Coping skills, in fact, reflect the character of a nation. The character of a nation and its core values determines whether or not a nation will, in fact, survive. Be it the fall of the Roman Empire, the fall of the Third Reich, or most other empires, the root causes usually point to some decay, self-indulgences, or failures of character traits that are frequently rooted in Western civilization. The loss of coping skills and that inability to accept reality will create a construct for which the society is not likely to be able to survive. The people will be incapable of coping with the problem and then crafting meaningful solutions. A core value is your philosophy about your way of life. A core value is intrinsically who you are. The core value is your character, your leadership, and your upbringing frame of reference. In the United States Marine Corps, for example, we teach leadership principles and leadership traits. Loyalty, justice, take responsibility, dependability, and courage are to name just a few. These principles and traits guide us in our dealings with fellow service members and the civilian leadership that we work for. They are the framework of a leader's coping skills, which are essential to the completion of our mission and the value we place on our Marines, soldiers, sailors, and airmen. A society's character are the principles or the structures under which the society functions and serve as the boundaries of acceptable behavior within a society. These boundaries can change over time. If the change is well thought out, the society will flourish. If the change is poorly thought out, the unintended consequences may in fact be the failure of that society. Many Americans today are confused about our national character and how we cope with those changes. What we stand for is not as clear as it once was for many, and how we interact with one another has certainly deteriorated. The core value is central to who you are. It is central to who the nation is. It is a voluntarily accepted societal norm coming from within the individual. A core value is personal. Coping is personal. Central to any national character is for the person to accept personal accountability for their actions. The significance of this debate is quite simple. If you undermine a nation's core values, you undermine the nation. Compassion is a core value. Coping is a core value. Taking responsibility for your actions is a core value. These three core values taken together and reinforcing one another benefit society greatly and set the stage for the long-term survival of the nation. When a nation loses its coping skills, however, the ability to take responsibility for your actions, to have compassion, to solve incredibly complex societal issues are severely undermined. Our nation is in deep trouble. For decades, we have postponed making difficult decisions. For decades, our solutions have focused on what we can do to others rather than what we can do ourselves. Our nation has been failing in our ability to cope with the reality of the problems we face. Until we achieve a mutual respect for one another and learn to disagree respectfully, our nation will never tackle our most difficult challenges. We will be doomed to failure. The next time you respond to someone, I would encourage you to determine whether or not you are acting with compassion, understanding, and persuasive logic. Your response says as much about you as it does our nation. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WBUQ-FM in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Keystone State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.